It's time for Taking It Down. We're a podcast amongst many in the Alabama Takes family. You'll hear from me in just a minute. But first, we have a podcast that might interest you. Give it a listen.
Hey, this is Jeremy from Polyphonic Press. Along with my co-host and best friend, John Van Dyke, we are exploring classic albums completely at random. At the top of each show, we have no idea what album we're going to be listening to. We have the patented random album generator to give us an album. Sometimes it's an album we're very familiar with, and sometimes it's an artist we have never heard of. Either way, it gives us a chance to really listen to these classic releases, and gives us insights that we may never have thought of before.
For something to come out of them. Agreed. Maybe he needed the other Beatles in the room at that time.
Well, I think so, and I think if you watch that Peter Jackson documentary from a few years ago about the Let It Be sessions, I think, you know, it was kind of, the writing was on the wall. I mean, they were breaking up.
John Lennon didn't sign the papers to officially dissolve the Beatles until 1974.
So if this sounds interesting, be sure to follow Polyphonic Press on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and everywhere else podcasts are available. We upload every Tuesday morning, and we strongly encourage you to listen along with us. Cheers.
Yeah, how are you? I'd like to know. Tell me what you got. Go to thealabamatake.com and use that button at the bottom that says send a message to any podcast and do it. Let us know how you're doing, or what you're watching, or what we get wrong. It happens. Leave a voice note, a voicemail, whatever you want to call it, to any of the podcasts we have going, or to all of them. We'll get them to the right people. I'm good. I've been crushing tape for this week's podcast. Just killing it. Just show after show. I'm about to talk to you in brief, without spoilers, about three. Baby Reindeer, Gonna Return to Sugar from Apple TV Plus, and Under the Bridge from Hulu. It may actually be a little longer than usual episode, but only slightly. For even more, though, get on that newsletter. Sign up. Why don't you? thealabamatake.com/newsletter. And, you know, we don't spoil anything until later. And it's only Shogun and The Sympathizer this week. Those two we will talk at length about and the episode specifics. But that's much later. We'll use timestamps. And you can click on those chapter designations if you like. Need them. But how about this new Netflix series, Baby Reindeer, huh? Have you seen it? I was on the fence about starting it. It's Thursday night. I plop down in the old recliner. Look at the clock. 30 minutes till bed if I'm to be a responsible adult. Okay. None of my stories are under 30 minutes. What now? You know, maybe surf the streaming apps and see what's new. Pick something for later. You know, what have I missed? I do see Baby Reindeer, and I've heard of it. I know I may want to watch it at some point, and then the magic number appears, 30 minutes. Each episode runs about a half hour. I mash play so hard and fast, folks. Fire up episode one. Let me recommend it for you. It's a weird title, Baby Reindeer. I get it. Weird title, but that makes sense pretty early. This show is definitely for you who like bizarre tales from your friends' weekend antics of swapping phone numbers and Snapchat info only to find that they've made a huge mistake. What particularly intrigued me before I even watched the show was the writer and creator of it is a stand-up comedian, Richard Gadd, and the series is based off his one-man play. So that's caught my attention a little. It's a play that's based on these true events in his life when someone began to get a little too obsessed with him and not in a fan of your comedy sort of way. And what makes these first three episodes cook, though, is how much information is revealed to you and the amount that you get that builds on one another. Gadd uses himself in the main role, but he goes by the character of Donnie. It's just a stand-in for real life. And I think we all probably love these shows where you think you have an idea of pretty much everything and then something new happens or is introduced and it doesn't flip the entire series on its head, but instead makes you laugh and say, what the fuck just happened? Or why are you doing this? Baby Reindeer has that in spades. Don't let the name hinder you. It's really good so far. Seven episodes. I'm very interested to see how this ends. It's doing a lot of good things well. It handles loneliness and how we accept ourselves and what makes us accept ourselves in a light I really haven't seen. And it makes good use and funny use of close-ups to add to sort of this, there's a bit of strangeness happening here. And it looks pretty good overall. I'd say that it even goes so far as to ask, what do we do to feel loved and appreciated? I'm for it. It's odd. It's funny. It's interesting. And you know what? It's 30 minutes. Let me run down a little bit more bits of TV. I don't know if I have a lot to add on the most recent episode of the Apple TV show Sugar. I enjoyed that fourth episode that most recently aired. It's titled Starry-Eyed. I was certainly thoroughly involved mentally with everything taking place. I don't know that it added a lot. It inched the mystery a little further on, beyond where it was like the week before. I think we're seeing some dots really being connected in that central mystery that John Sugar is tasked to solve, especially with the final scene from this most recent episode. But it didn't really answer any of that spoiler-related stuff I talked about here last week, so we'll see if they get around to that and when. Perhaps there was something in the doctor's visit, so no spoilers, I won't say much anything else. But even that felt so overt that it doesn't feel like a hint in the show. Doesn't matter to me because Colin Farrell's nailing it. He's wonderful to watch. He's made for this role somehow. Lastly, though, is Under the Bridge from Hulu. It is not a Red Hot Chili Peppers documentary. Believe it or not, they ripped that idea from the Chili Peppers. How dare they? No, this is a fictionalized version of a true story of a missing girl in Canada in 1997. And it's based off the book by the same name, written by Rebecca Godfrey. The book was pretty popular. Got really good reviews, so maybe some of you have read it. The actual show itself stars Lily Gladstone, fresh off her Oscar nomination for Killers of the Flower Moon. She's the police officer who's investigating the disappearance. And Riley Keough is the author stand-in. She's in the small town from New York to attempt to write a book about her hometown. And our guy Ashtray from Euphoria makes an appearance in this first episode. Yo, Ashtray. But Under the Bridge, the series does a couple of things I did not find compelling. And one of which is how they're portraying the author within the show. It seems unnecessary to even get to the center of the mystery to have her there. Apparently in real life, she didn't get into the town until well after the crime. The second thing that it's not quite living up to what it could be is it just does not feel crafted like a really excellent show should. But I'm going to forgive it because the story itself is enough to carry the weight. And assuming they let Lily Gladstone go a little deeper with some of her acting skills than what she was allowed in the first episode, it could get better. I did find it immensely watchable, though, because I'm so eager to see what happened. Would this be for someone who has read the book? I just don't think so. I don't know what you're gaining. You know the story. In fact, I'd say that this might even be a watered-down version of what the book gives you. Huge swaths of it are completely fictionalized. They've added this depressed grime layer to the fabricated version of the author. I just don't think it works. But still want to see what happens. Like most in this genre, I'm not as buoyant about how it's presented, I guess. I guess it's just the genre. The genre of taking a true crime event and making it a series gets too hamstrung by the tropes. And maybe the creators here are just too afraid to push against those boundaries. Under the Bridge is getting into a couple of interesting segments of society that's marginalized. You don't see it a lot. You know, teen girls who are either abandoned by parents or can't be raised by them or be troubled enough that they sent into a home. They're not orphaned. You know, what happens to them? And better yet, what happens when we don't care or we push people like that to the fringes? What happens to them and then us? It could pull off and become good television. We'll see. Let's get you into the heart of our show with me, Adam, and Donovan. Here we go.
Alabama Tape Projection.
Hello. It's us taking it down. Donovan's with me. Adam's with me. We're going to jump right in without spoiling anything. We've talked at length about Shogun. We don't retract our recommendation. It's in the ninth and penultimate episode what more could we say other than if you haven't watched it, you probably should. I really do think a lot of people will enjoy it. What I do want to talk about, since we're in the spoiler-free part of the show, is The Sympathizer. Its first episode dropped on HBO and HBO Max. Well, HBO Max. They don't call it that anymore, do they?
No. It's just Max. And the genius who was responsible for that lost a lot of money and got a pay raise. So David Zaslav is doing fine.
I got to be honest with you guys. I'm very bad at deleting apps on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
They offload after a certain time if I'm not using them.
Mm-hmm.
But, mm-hmm. I mean, my home screen is just littered with ghosts of HBO app pasts. You know, like Max and then HBO Go. And I've had the phone for too long.
I was hoping you'd say Tubi.
Tubi?
Is it that? Wait, what was the other one? It's not Tubi. It's
Tubi's the free one, right?
No, I was thinking the really dumb one where they thought they could air shows 5 minutes at a time. We used to make fun of it with regularity.
Quibi.
Quibi.
Because it was Quick Bites.
And Blaine called it Quibi. Which was great. But none of us knew how to pronounce it, so.
Because we didn't give a shit, is why.
And apparently, like, when he fired everyone, he played a song from, like, Trolls 2 or something about not giving up or something. Like, when he announced that they had lost billions of dollars.
I was hoping you were going to say
keep going.
That he played either Coldplay's Fix You or U2's With or Without You.
Fix You would have been perfect for that staff meeting. That's like a Toranaga level staff meeting right there. That's some real excitement.
He played the theme song for Laura Palmer, which would probably actually work.
It actually works for everything.
It really does. Just play it all the time. What can we say about The Sympathizer without spoiling a thing? And we definitely want to say if we recommend it, don't, or do with maybe a certain qualification.
At least my impression of the first episode is, good director directs goodly.
Yeah. Park Chan-wook, right?
I like Park Chan-wook. If y'all have not seen The Handmaiden, that is extremely good. I think it's on Amazon right now. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
That's super good. You know, it's hard to say what a show is going to be like based on the first episode, but I found this one engaging. Like, there was a puzzle-y element at first that I wasn't sure of and then completely worked for me. And I'd give it two big thumbs up. I thought it was great.
Yeah, the puzzle clicks into place about 30 minutes in, and you're perfectly
fine.
Yeah,
once everything starts to really hum.
Yes.
And this is not a spoiler, because it's in all the commercials, but, you know, Robert Downey Jr. plays, like, six different roles, so if you want to see him with a weird haircut, you're in luck.
Yes. It's not even in a trailer. It's in the Max app. When you click on the show, his image is in a bunch of different costumes.
I'll have to see how that works throughout the whole show. And it seems like as a gimmick, at least for this first one, it's like, it's fine. Like, he's a good actor. He did a good job. I'm interested to see if it really adds anything to it. But
right. I thought he nailed it in this one, though.
He's very good.
Yes, I thought that was maybe some of his best acting I've seen in a very long time.
Agreed, because, you know, he does have a tendency to sometimes sleepwalk through stuff.
A little, or just be Robert Downey Jr.
That's what I mean. Yes. Like, he kind of, like, you know, just getting about. It's like when Colin Farrell is in a role where he doesn't have to do anything but be Irish.
Mm.
You know, and it's like, yeah, I get it. And then you see him in a role where he has to act, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, you know, you're actually good.
Another good actor who's guilty of this is George Clooney does this.
Absolutely.
Where he's just George Clooney.
He's just getting by on his charm.
Which is fine, because sometimes you just want to see George Clooney.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Here, Robert Downey Jr. is doing a little bit of the Robert Downey Jr., but it's like dialed back at times and like in a certain role of a CIA guy. So it's good stuff.
I do believe that, like, I mean, he's a pretty recognizable person, right? But like, if you maybe weren't paying a ton of attention, like, he's doing, you know, he's not up there doing Tony Stark or whatever. Mm-mm. Like, it's different enough that maybe you could be like, oh, I didn't realize that was Robert Downey Jr. until, you know, the credits rolled.
Maybe.
I find it unlikely, but it's possible.
I do recommend The Sympathizer because the lead role is not Robert Downey Jr., despite all our attention here. The lead is a guy who is utterly captivating. I've never seen this actor before.
he has basically been in like one thing before this.
Well, he is. He's wonderful.
Great. Yeah.
He is wonderful. You was just you're drawn to him and you want to pull for him. So good casting there from Downey and his production team. It's an A24 production as well, if that helps you make a decision. For some, it does. I love the first episode. I was thrilled by it. And we'll get into the specifics of why on the back half. For now, we're in the penultimate episode of the wildly popular FX Hulu series Shogun. This one titled Crimson Sky, episode 9. By the way, spoiler territory here. There's really nothing more romantic than offering to second your girlfriend at seppuku.
I was so aroused, I had to leave the room.
I do this for my wife every day, I say. Would you like for me to chop your head off?
I'll absolutely cut your head off, as I promised at our wedding.
You know, I have to say, the difference in lasting love and the fling that they have enjoyed, if he really loved her, he would have had her pull her hair up. That was going to be messy.
like when someone's vomiting, you hold their hair back.
Right. Yeah. You don't want that hair hanging down.
The opening scene is of Mariko and her past. Mm-hmm. We finally get why she was out in the cold. We got like a 30-second flashback here and there of her walking in the cold. She was just going to die. She was going to freeze to death, right?
Yes. As she said like last week with her husband, right? Like, I just want to get away from you in this life, and I want to die as, you know, because of my family and my father.
What it allows for is to show us how she becomes connected to the priest, Priest Martin. And
I actually kind of like that guy.
I can't stand him. I think he's smarmy. I know you can't. Adam, where are you? Break the tie here.
The actor's doing a great job because on the one hand, you personally like him, you know, as a foil to just the machine of the guy he works for, essentially. I know that's, priests do not work for other priests, but you know, basically.
They hire.
He basically does, yeah.
But yeah, he's still got a little bit of the grease to him, as you said, there, Blaine. Mm-hmm.
He's slimy. Opening scene in present day, we get that, oh, what a sense of danger you get from the camera work alone, rising to show the city. Just a little dread there of it rising to see. They're going to welcome in Blackthorn, Mariko, Yabusheje. Oh, man. They're going to be welcomed into Osaka and treated as polite prisoners, polite hostages.
Honored guests.
Wink, wink.
And they are honored to be there.
They're so pleased.
They're really there to present Torunaga's surrender, but Mariko lets it be known, okay, now that I'm done with the surrender, there's his list. These guys here are surrendering to you. I gotta get back. We got a staff meeting.
Yes. She's making her play. She's starting to see Torunaga's plan here, and it all hinges on her.
She repeats the I'm ready in the episode, which is her last bit of dialogue last week. Mm-hmm. You get the idea that Torunaga probably told her, look, you're going to have to go up there. You might have to commit seppuku in order for this to work.
Is the main question in the dialogue these last couple weeks, is Torunaga a good person?
He is certainly willing to use his the loyalties of his subordinates, but also, you know, like I do think there's an element of like, that's almost how they expect to be used.
Right.
Like he's yeah. not, even, or Mariko, like, right. He's like, this episode is like, you know, life and death are the same, you know, they can both have meaning. Blackthorn rightly points out that one is very permanent.
Right. Right. And he is there to be our voice in that world.
Yes.
to point out different values of life and death. But they do drive it home over and over again. Even the foot soldier that dies in front of her during that, I'm sure we'll get to this showdown at the gate.
Yeah.
Says it's been an honor to serve or fight for you or however he phrases it. And he knows that he is seconds away from death and still does that. So I think we're playing by different rules, yet we're also melding cultures when she's very concerned about the effects of her suicide. So I don't know, we're kind of back to draw the world as you understand it to be, what he told him in, episode 2.
what's happening here is Torinaga just absolutely understands how the game's played. I know how to use the game to my advantage. If this is the way the world works, deal with it, because I'm going to use it. It's kind of funny that some of these other people haven't figured that out yet.
It's almost like he has transcended the game that they're playing and like understands the complex morality and just gets on. Like you're saying, it's when they say an athlete, you know, the game is moving really slow for him.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
He's kind of doing that to everyone else. And it doesn't make him like the most moral, upstanding guy possibly, but he's using the conventions of his time and place to do what he thinks is right. I guess that's the question, is like, is he trying to do what he thinks is right? Is he making a power play? Is he good because he's the best of 4 to 5 not good dudes?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think I'm inclined to be like, because I think I said this last week and the first time we talked about it too. Like, I definitely have the like, kind of like the, like he's one of the protagonists bias, right? So you're kind of on his side, right, rooting for him. But I do think that it is kind of like, for me, the viewer, he's the best of, yeah, like 4 other pretty bad options, right? And who, especially Ishido, who really does seem to be making a power play, right? Because supposedly none of these people rule, right? They're all just regents for the heir, who, yeah, I don't know, even remember his name. Supposedly they're all going to give up power when he turns whatever, right? So,
well, have we given the guy with leprosy a chance here? Have we given him a good shot?
I think that we need to be okay with calling a gentleman with leprosy kind of a dick.
in both appearance and action.
No, he's kind of been a jerk until you know, they got their cage rattled at the gate.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into that. She moves through the sectors where there are gated parts, of course. Viewers know.
We've all played Age of Empires here.
Yes.
Yeah. She's got her small crew. She's determined to leave. She told Ishido, look, I'm leaving whether you want me to or not, because my loyalty is with Torinaga and he needs me back. He's got a few more days of mourning. I got to get back to him.
That was in a wonderfully acted all around, mm-hmm, but especially by her court, yes, scene.
So fantastic.
I don't want to blow past that.
That really, really was fantastic, especially where, like, she, you know, like, she states who she is and lays it all out and basically is saying that, like, we, you know, this polite fiction that we're honored guests, we understand that it's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you, you know, would quit interrupting me, I'll tell you what I'm going to do about it. Mm-hmm. But, man, she is so good. Mm-hmm. It is all on her. You know, this whole episode really was another one where I felt that Blackthorn was a little bit in the background because it's all on her, and I loved it.
It was great. I mean, and Torinaga's not even in it, and he's
no
a central character in the episode, yet is not on screen.
His shadow is over it, but it really all hinges on Mariko.
I would argue that she's been like that the whole season, though. What you said, Donovan, how she's just crucial to everything and maybe the most important person.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's a series of bait-and-switch things that happen to me with this show. One is that Blackthorn is the main character, and I suppose he is, yeah, but he's also like our view into a world and kind of our voice.
Yes.
But she has the arc, right? I mean, his arc is like, I learned some cultural things and a few words of Japanese. Hers is...
He got a cool robe, too.
He looks good. I loved when he went to the meeting. He was still... It's like me when I have to wear a suit, not totally comfortable, like kind of fidgety and like, you know, pressing
tugging
down
at
the
it.
Jacket. And,
yeah.
No, she was just fantastic. And the other bait and switches as we get into what happened at the gate, you think, you know, I thought maybe, oh, Blackthorn's going to show them the value, the dignity of life. You know, he's going to get through to the small crew. And, you know, then you get to the gate and you think, oh, this one samurai dressed in way cooler armor than any of these bad guys just took 2 out like it was nothing. They're about to blast their way out of here. No, they're not. That illusion doesn't hold.
Yeah, that it continues up until the very end. But Mariko's seppuku was played so well because as a viewer, you were just sure it was going to happen after how Hiromatsu sacrificed himself for Torinaga last week. So it's a huge sigh of relief that she does it. And it feels like relief. which of course makes the very end, her own sacrifice, just that much more of a gut punch.
The little things that she did physically after Ishido, you know, his message arrives or whatever, he gets there and says, fine, you can leave, were just so good. You know, didn't even say anything, but couldn't get her leg back underneath her. But it was all so subtle. It wasn't like hand to chest or so good.
We were kind of laughing at it to start this out, but I really thought this was an episode that I really loved. So basically my my review of everything was, it was great. It was shot well and acted well.
Mm-hmm.
But Blackthorne and Mariko, the actors portraying them, had such great chemistry when he's like, you know, says, I'll do it. I'll be your second. I'll cut your head off.
Oh, yeah.
So you aren't condemned to hell. And it's not really words. It's all just body language. They've been great the whole series, right? Like, obviously they have chemistry, but I think this was like a huge payoff moment.
With Mariko's death at the end, does Yabusheji get a shot at redemption at all with you guys? You know, we've loved him, but is he done now for you?
I know, when he stabs his own guy, it's just like, you scamp.
It was kind of hard to figure out what he was up to. I couldn't tell if he was letting Toranaga's men in at first.
Uh-huh.
Who were the intruders, the ninja-like characters there? By the way, Adam, you do great research for our show, and I'm not kidding. What was the tapping on the shoulder by the intruder when he was standing there with Yabusheji?
Were they telling how many people were in the compound, perhaps?
Perhaps? I haven't
done any research. That's the only thing I could think of.
I was kind of thinking, like, this is either, like, he's conveying some kind of information, but I don't know what.
Though I was laughing, again, to continue playing on Donovan's, what a scamp. Like, I still can't dislike him here. He seems kind of confused by the tapping, you know?
Yes, he did.
That's why I asked. He didn't know what, he's like, what like, are you?
What the hell are you doing? He seemed confused by that and alarmed at how many people were coming in.
Like
a kid who has left the water on in the tub or something, and now the water's going everywhere, and this is not going according to plan.
No, that was it, and I think he played that perfectly. I think that's what he was supposed to have done.
I mean, he definitely is, like, throughout the series, right? Like, they've done a very good job of just emphasizing how much he is not in control of things.
Oh, no.
Like, he's always trying to play the game, and he's always trying to work to advantage, but he always kind of like outsmarts himself and ends up.
These people who try to play the game and fail, you know, you have everything from Toranaga's son on through. I mean, even the regents are, you know, Ishido is imitating what a power grab should be. He's not, he doesn't have the gravitas of Toranaga to actually pull it off.
Right.
And yet our guy, our lovable little scamp, continues to like make moves, be likable, and be slippery enough to not have to pay for anything.
I know.
He really is a snake at the end of this one, right? Because not just letting the attackers in, but then he won't move the whatever heavy object, the chest or whatever.
Yes, he doesn't help Blackthorne at all. And the way he plays it is just like, it's funny, and also you want to push him. Maybe not punch him, but you want to just push him because he's like, well, it just can't be moved. There's no point in going over there. You know, he's got that look on his face like, there's no point in trying.
I do like that actor. He's almost like, you won't almost want to call it like wounded innocence when he's like, there are attackers. Who knew?
But also to go back a little in time, his plan, which he doesn't ever vocalize, and kudos to the show for not showing their hand hardly ever in this show and just letting you follow along. But his plan is to offer up Blackthorne. Like, here, I got you a prisoner. You like what I brought you? And it doesn't work at all. It's like, we don't want a barbarian. What's the point?
He really does seem like he, like Toranaga said of him last episode, right? Like, he's a goshawk. Like, he's short-sighted and you always know what he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's a guy who doesn't understand the big picture at all.
The only thing that would have made this episode better would be if Yabusheji, after he got refused of the prisoner, like, you can have this as a gift. And when they said no, if he would have went back and whispered to somebody, we got to draw up another will.
I think that he offered him as a prisoner because he now has value to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he likes him.
Hmm. That's interesting.
He, like, wants to speak Japanese with him, and if it were any other character insisting that Mariko not go with him to act as an interpreter, you would think, oh, they're kind of trying to screw him over a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think he's like, no, you got it.
Yeah. I'm so happy. I'm a sap. I'm so happy that Mariko and Blackthorn got another moment to rekindle their love. If she would have died without them hooking back up, I think I would have been a little disappointed. More
than
a little.
Can you imagine how hot it is right after you had to practically cut someone's head off? It just must be insane.
Well, you know, stressful situations tend to draw people together in that way. So, yeah.
We got to see Blackthorn's pretty good with his gun, too. In more ways than one, right?
I have been waiting on the moment to discuss his gun.
Let's talk about it. He finally gets to use his gun. He's been dying to use it. And pretty capable, because there's this one part where he shoots a hole in order to grab someone and hold them so he can shoot another hole through the wall and kill them. He's done this before.
Yeah, he's got ninja levels, you know. He's clearly at ninja level.
The breaking of the silence and the way that everyone's moving through the compound at night and the deadly grace with which it's all happening by him just shooting somebody.
Yes, it's perfect for his character.
It's great. And we have waited 9 episodes for that moment of like, well, here he comes. It's the ultimate, like, so anyway, I go in blasting.
There is a little element of like the Raiders of the Lost Ark scene, right? Yeah. The sword fighter, mm-hmm, where he comes, mm-hmm, and then Harrison Ford just shoots him.
the ninja guys do knock his gun out of his hand briefly, so
yes,
it didn't work totally. Speaking of Blackthorn, the drawing of the sand in the sand, or excuse me, I guess they're pebble sand. How did y'all read that? Where he just stood there with the one line in the perfectly curated sand.
I don't know if we're supposed to take that as like him kind of saying, I have tried to understand this culture, and now this, you know, especially with Mariko's slavish obedience, to say like this, the logic is failing me here. I have admired and tried to learn as much as I can, but now this is, you know, he's scratching at like the facade in a way.
I think I read it that way too, where it's like, he's like, I am funded, like my individualism and is fundamentally out of step.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to say.
I cannot get some level. I can understand folks, but also I cannot understand them at all.
Yeah. I saw it as the line is kind of representative of him coming in and disrupting the beautiful, or he feels as though he is. Disrupting the rules and the beauty that they have laid out, this perfectly designed thing, and he feels, or maybe this whole situation is a disruption of that. Crimson Sky was a bit of a red herring as a title, seems like, right?
Man, what a great tease, huh? Because even last week we'd been like, this is when Game of Thrones, you know, every prestige show, you know, this is when Game of Thrones has the big battle. I loved it. Like, thanks for the great bait and switch. Thank you. It was good.
Like Adam said, that's been a motif of the series.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Hats off.
But in a way that feels earned to me.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not trickery.
Right. Yeah, this didn't feel cheap at all.
Not cheap, not tricks, but very... Now, there's a band name. Cheap Trick. But, yeah.
I'm just sad we only got one left. I honestly don't, because I'm not looking at the novel or anything, so yeah, I don't really know how things are going to turn out. So I don't, honestly, it's like it still seems like we have a lot to resolve.
How could they possibly do it?
It's my understanding that Yabusheje is getting his own spinoff series where he comes to England.
Perfect.
Wouldn't that be great? The expressions he could make in England, not understanding a word.
He discovers the public houses.
Please let him go. I love, as I've probably said with every episode, but just how well crafted and shot everything is. Like Adam described, like the chaos and confusion of the shinobi attack combined with Blackthorn. Everything about the confrontation in the gates was great, up to Mariko taking her Naginata and the soldiers not being able to harm her, but not being just great. It looked great. It just, the camera works so in such concert with the story they're telling, it's truly good.
any other viewers who fell in love with Mariko, just message me and we'll mourn together.
Yeah.
She's so good.
At least Fuji's still out there. I kind of like Fuji.
Fuji's great, but she's no Mariko.
Well, she's no Mariko, of course.
But she's wonderful. Gotta think she's got to pop back up at some time, but maybe not. I don't know. Maybe she's served her duties. Let's take a break for station identification. We're back. We're going to offer up some brief thoughts with spoilers on the first episode of The Sympathizer, HBO and A24's adaptation of Viet Thanh Nguyen's 2016 novel. It's a piece of fiction, which I didn't know if it was fiction or nonfiction. I'm glad I know now. Oh. That's why I said it with a little hesitancy. It won a Pulitzer Prize, though.
Yes, his debut novel.
Too. Wow.
I believe he'd written, don't quote me on this, I think he'd written like short stories and published before, but he came out swinging for the novel.
Wow. Impressive. It opens with the book and the show. Opens with a quoted passage, quoted by many, I suppose. All wars are fought twice, the first time on the battlefield, the second time in memory. Good opening quote. Love the aesthetic here of everything looking like it came straight from 1975.
Sometimes you get a prestige drama and it's like, okay, we get it. But like, I think HBO, like when HBO is really trying,
mm-hmm.
like it looks fabulous.
It really does. I thought about the set design so much during this in a very nerdy way, perhaps. I get into that kind of thing. I'm like, man, that had to take forever to recreate that look of Saigon.
It worked so well for me. For me, it created such a mood.
Oh, yeah.
Too, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Really, it was almost a set design and, of course, the acting and what's going on in the background really felt almost, like, oppressive to me by the end of it. Thinking about, like, this city is actually, like, the city is falling.
Mm-hmm.
The city is being taken over again. Anyway, the Vietnam War seems really cool. Did we win?
No.
Did anyone win?
Let me introduce you to a man named Henry Kissinger.
I say the thesis of this show may well turn out to be, hey, nobody really won it.
Oh, I'd say we lost it completely.
Oh, no, of course, but we lost it. Well, I mean, even just a little bit before this point, right? Nixon's like, we're going to end the war, right? Because it's popular at home. Kissinger's like, the North Koreans won't end the war unless we inflict extremely heavy casualties.
North Vietnamese.
Did I say North Koreans? North Vietnamese. Okay. Unless we inflict extremely heavy casualties. So they kept the war going on for a couple more years, lost about 20,000 more American lives, and killed probably 1 million to 2 million Vietnamese people just because that's what they thought the calculus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the politics of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that really kind of sucks.
If I was a full-time podcaster, I would have rewatched Ken Burns' Vietnam mm-hmm. as a prep for this. That show documentary was so dense that I'd mm-hmm. forgotten everything about it almost. But it's also really good and fascinating and sad.
Yeah.
So what we have here with The Sympathizer is a piece of fiction. It's a Vietnam War era story narrated through prison letters of a nameless double agent from the North and the South. He's from the North or sympathizes with the North, wants communist North to be in control. That's who he's pulling for. And he's down in the South very much as a mole. Everybody buys him as captain in the army. Vietnam era stories do for me what Napoleon era stories do for Adam. I am so in on a Vietnam era story. So he's right under the general and also in contact with an important CIA agent played by Robert Downey Jr., we mentioned in the top. He's the right-hand man of the general, though, and they're on the cusp of the fall of Saigon. That's where the story begins. I suppose the story really begins with him in prison writing. You see this. Then we flash back to the fall of Saigon or a couple of months right before. We talked about this at the top, but I just can't get enough of, and let me just go ahead and butcher his poor name here. I could not get enough of Hoa Zuande. The primary actor, the protagonist here is is the Vietnamese.
Well, I thought he was great throughout it. He's narrating it, right? He's our anchor. He's our way in. But then a couple times, Park Chan-wook showed the same scene over again, but you've got new information.
Yeah, he did. Yes, he did
that. And I always liked that. I thought like the acting was very good there, where it's like the first time you see this scene, you read it one way. The second time, you know, you read it this way. I don't like really have this formed in my head yet, but I did think there was a little bit of like, for the South Vietnamese and the Americans at this point, it's like, what are you fighting for? It's over. Just get out of there. Don't, you know, why keep up the struggle? And I think that kind of tied with the captain's like, okay, it's almost over. Like, my fight is almost over. And then being told that he has to prolong the struggle.
Oh, yeah. He's told about midway through that, no, you've got to stay with the general, because when he goes to America, he's going to be up to no good over there.
Yeah, he'll be organizing against Vietnam.
Right.
The new country. Or the newly reunified country, I should say.
Part of the complexity of what's going to be happening is our sympathizer, from the title, has two blood brothers who are practically like brothers to him. Bon, who's very much a South Vietnamese fighter, in the Air Force for the South Vietnam.
I think he's paratrooper.
Paratrooper. And yeah. Mon, now he is also a bit of a mole, except he's a dentist in South.
No one ever suspects a dentist.
They do not. Now, that is true. We also get early in the show one of the ladies who's involved, who has gotten caught by our protagonist, the captain here. And they're having to wait on her to poop out some film.
She knows that he
right
is a mole as well.
Yes, and she tells...
And so they have to be in the room and pretend they don't know what the other person
it's
knows.
That classic spy trope, yeah. Perhaps that I know you're a mole, you know I'm a, you know that I know you, we just can't act like it. And she tells him to hit her. I mean,
yes,
he you can tell he's kind of a good guy from that scene where he's just like, you, the look on his face is, I do not want to hit you at all.
His own guys are even like, oh, she's asking for a kiss, right? So he's getting it from everywhere.
Uh-huh.
We are definitely meant to sympathize with this guy, and you know what, from the beginning I do. He seems earnest, idealistic. He doesn't hate the South Vietnamese people. He's, you know, he doesn't like the government, which, to be fair to him, was historically pretty corrupt and awful. So, mm-hmm. You know, he seems sincere. Maybe even, like, is he naively sincere? I don't think we're supposed to think that, but I wonder, like, because he seems like he's a true believer.
That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't feel like he's cynical in the way that the CIA agent portrayed by Robert Downey Jr. comes across as cynical, right? Where he's like, nope, well, we lost the game here, so we'll figure something else out.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually matters to him. This is all supposition on my part.
We're going to get a lot more of this in the days to come.
Definitely.
In the episodes to come. But Claude, the CIA agent, played by Robert Downey Jr., likes him, that's for sure.
Yes, he does.
Maybe likes him more than he does the general.
I think he definitely likes him more than he likes the general.
Yeah, he's a bit condescending to the general at times, Claude.
Yes.
We don't have a lot to go with so far because it's only the one episode, but as a first episode, I thought it was pretty good.
I think it did a lot of different things. It had action, it had the suspense, it had the what I really enjoyed, right, was... For America with Vietnam, it's like we kind of like, okay, we settled in Paris, right? Mm-hmm. And then we get to go, everyone gets to go back to America, and we get to spend, you know, the next 50 years writing the things they carried or whatever and figuring ourselves out. The folks that lived in Vietnam, like the Vietnamese people, like they're not just an afterthought, right? Like they're a crucial, and seeing like our allies being treated as an afterthought was like kind of upsetting, but also... really makes you think, especially as we, you know, I mean, even in my life, our lifetimes, we've done somewhat the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Also, man, the whole, when they're going for the C-130, which is the big transport plane, and the fall of Saigon is more and more imminent, and they are being shelled on the runway, on the bus. Well, that was very heart in your throat.
huge
scene for me.
Yes, it is. It's a bit devastating.
It is extremely devastating.
Now, you mentioned to me in private that your wife watched this episode with you, and she had nightmares about that scene.
Yes, she does. She does not do war stuff. And then, of course, like, compound, like, artillery barrage with a dead baby.
Mm-hmm.
That's just... I will be watching the rest of this show by myself. I'm like, they're going to America. Sandra Oh's going to be in it. It's going to be fun. Nah, we're done.
There is a funny tone happening here. It's with the blend of flippant and then this gravitas of his brother, so to speak, and the baby dying. Now, did the wife also die?
I assume so. I mean, maybe we'll find out she didn't, but I assume they both died, the wife and the baby.
Brutal, brutal, brutal stuff with that image of the baby, man. It's tough to handle.
It's tough.
But at the same time, there are moments of levity in this episode.
You know, the one that made me laugh the most was when they're at, all three of them, the three friends are drinking at the cafe, and one of the other soldiers there calls... the captain, like a half-breed or whatever, because I forget if it's his mother or father who's French, but I think one of his parents is French.
French.
And his paratrooper friend, who's like almost too drunk to stand, starts fighting. And there he and his friend, the dentist, the captain and the dentist, are having like an actual like discussion about like spy stuff in the background. This guy's taking on like 20 guys. And at the end of it, he's like, should I go help him?
Yeah. The fight continues in the background, which is very much a comedy kind of thing.
It made me laugh so hard. That was great.
But they're sitting there talking, and the captain, I think this is the scene where he tells, man, I was fascinated and repulsed when he was in America. And man tells him, that's what loving America
is.
That's
what people mean when they say they love America. And I'm like, that's a pretty good line.
That is, because I think that's how I feel.
I think... there's a lot of how I feel too, honestly, where like you have the stuff that it's like, this is fascinating and this part is even inspiring. And then like, there's so much that is utterly repulsive and they're in a constant tug of war with each other, depending on what day it is, you know?
You're right. My favorite moment of comedy was when Claude's character, Robert Downey Jr.'s character of Claude tells the general, I'm 1/16th black. And the general says, why do all these Ivy League guys have to say that they have blood of a black person in them?
That was very funny. Yes, I forgot. I actually forgot about that.
Why do they do that? That's a good question.
It's like the one, my great-great-grandmother was Cherokee, right? It's like, no.
That's what we heard in the South a lot. I heard that in the South, like in small town Southern. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I have a great-great-great-great-grandfather who was Native American.
Right, yeah.
Which is, you know, meaningless. It's also reminiscent of I've got a friend who's black.
That is definitely where I see that it's coming in. It's Eastern like, no, I can say that. I've got, you know, I'm 1/16th of whatever.
Right. It's also a nod to Robert Downey Jr.'s character in Rolling Thunder.
Tropic Thunder. Yeah,
Tropic Thunder, I'm sorry. Rolling Thunder's the Bob Dylan tour.
Well, another funny enough, another movie about Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Very much. We don't have a ton to say because it's only the first episode. I loved it.
Same.
If nothing else, I just love Vietnam era stories, but this looks like it could be doing something interesting.
I'm really excited to see what's going to happen when they go to America, because it will have to be so different from what we have seen
right
in this episode. But based on the way everything, I would describe that the episode was handled very deftly. You know, where it's like it moved, everything really clicked. I'm excited to see what lies in store for us, and I'm excited based on this first episode. The people who are running this know what they're doing.
I wonder if I will be as enthralled once they get to America, but
I'm wondering too, because you were saying part of the the setting is fascinating to you.
It is.
Like, I thought it, well, for me honestly, the setting was very sad and oppressive for me, which makes it sound like I didn't like it, and I did like it, but I also knew like this is somewhat prologue, because I know a lot of it is going to happen in the United States.
Right. Yeah, the bulk of the story will be happening after the Vietnam War, which is, it's just the era, and, you know, that was the pebble in the water. The ripples are coming, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, we might end up talking about it more next week. We'll find out. We will definitely be talking about Shogun, because its finale will have aired.
I got the finale. I'm not ready, Blaine.
I want more Shogun. And with that, follow us online, talk to us, go to the site, sign up to the newsletter, thealabamatake.com/newsletter. What else do you need to know? You can leave us a voice message. I don't know if we've lost our mind with that. We could grab that voice message and drop it into the episode and talk to you that way.
You could be famous.
You could be famous as us. Okay. For Adam and Donovan, see you guys later.